I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Original Minds. I'm standing in for Elijah Howarth, who is unavailable today. And today, I'm going to be interviewing my guest, Bill Plotkin. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Anthony. Great to be here.
And Bill is a psychologist, and you're going to be giving a talk tonight at the Dance Palace at about 7 p.m., and then a workshop tomorrow in Bolinas from 10 to 4.
That's the rumor, as I understand it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're here to talk about your book called Wild Mind. What is wild mind?
A wild mind is a whole mind.
Whole mind.
A mind that has, it's a person who has access to the full rainbow spectrum of resources that is our birthright as human beings. It's a person with a wild mind has all the capacities on board that we were gifted by nature by virtue of being born human.
So you're a Western psychologist by training.
I am.
And we were talking before we went on the air, and your degree is in clinical psychology or experimental or both?
It's actually in experimental psychology. I was a research psychologist back in the 70s, primary area of study being consciousness.
Oh, really?
Non-ordinary states of consciousness.
Oh, my goodness.
And I also took all the clinical courses, too, while I was in grad school.
Sure.
And did a postdoc in clinical psychology afterwards.
Right. And you got your degree from CU Boulder?
Indeed. Yep. Colorado.
And you have an organization there that is called Animas?
In Colorado, in Durango, Colorado.
Okay. Animas. Tell us a little bit about Animas, what you guys do there.
We offer contemporary nature-based programs for the discovery of soul, for each individual to discover the mysteries, the particular genius of their that they were born with. And at Animas, we have about 20 guides.
Mm-hmm.
We refer to ourselves as nature-based underworld guides.
Underworld guides.
That's a term that's not that familiar.
No.
And it might actually give the wrong impression to contemporary people, but the underworld is the place of soul, really. It's the place of fruitful spiritual darkness. And in mythologies and traditions all over the world and healthy cultures, we find that the way it's spoken about is that to discover the greatest mysteries of our individual lives, we actually go down. Into the depths. It's not a descent into hell. Hell is
no.
A Western religious idea that's very limited, actually, in its understanding. It's more like what the Greeks refer to as Hades.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So yeah. The underworld is this place of the deepest secrets and mysteries of our individual psyches. And you can think of the underworld as dark, but by dark we don't mean...
Not illuminated.
Yes, exactly. It's mysterious. It's the aspects of the world and of life we don't know about yet.
And it's such a rich place.
It's where everything we don't know is waiting for us. Yeah.
Well, and it's kind of, there's a loose term called the unconscious or the subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And is that what you're talking about? I mean, because I know that Jung had this idea of the collective unconscious. And
yes.
So it's including all of these terms.
Yes, the underworld includes, or at least the idea is resonant with both the
right.
Personal and the collective unconscious.
So in what your company does, do you guys go on wilderness excursions with people to help them get in touch with this underworld, or...?
Yes, maybe half of our programs are based at retreat centers or at the edge of wild places, so that we're not excluding participants who aren't camping all
right.
the time or backpacking.
Right.
And then about half of our programs are either based at car camps or we actually put our backpacks on and wander some distance into the wilds.
Yes, and you've been wandering in Point Reyes here.
Last couple of days, my partner Janine Haugen and I have been here for a couple of days.
And you enjoyed SkyTrail, you were telling me this morning.
We were up on SkyTrail, that area, yesterday.
Yeah.
Very different than the desert southwest where we live.
Yeah, yeah.
The profusion of green everywhere. As Janine says, the sky full of blossoms.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. Yeah. So being a Western-trained psychologist, in your book, Wild Mind, and by the way, the Animus has a website.
We do.
And what is that?
It's www.animus.org. And Animus is probably better pronounced. The Spanish pronunciation is Animas.
Mm-hmm.
And the spelling is A-N-I-M-A-S. And it's Spanish for plural for souls. And we call it that simply because that's where we started in Durango, Colorado. And it's the Valley of the River of Souls Lost in Purgatory, as the Spanish missionaries referred to it.
What a great
Animus
place.
River. It was the Spanish missionaries were actually projecting their own loss of soul onto the native people.
Oh, really?
This Christian idea that the old missionary idea that we have to bring God's word and presence to these native people.
Supposedly
heathen people, but I'm quite convinced the missionaries had lost their own souls.
Yeah.
And they thought of the native people as having lost theirs, but they had it backwards.
Yeah. 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 And so that the native people were actually caring for the missionaries.
In some ways, or at least offering.
Yeah. 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 So, again, as a Western-trained psychologist, in your book, Wild Mind, you say it's time to take a look at a holistic and ecological look at the human psyche. And so this is a book that's kind of like a topography or a guide. As you say, it's a field guide to the human psyche.
It is.
And it's time to make a fresh start with Western psychology. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's quite a claim, huh?
Well,
Western psychology started in the late 19th century. We think of Sigmund Freud in particular as one of the originators, and coming out of...
And his teachers, too, like Charcot and Bernheim at the Nancy School. He got trained in hypnosis in France and then came to Vienna with that.
Exactly, yep. The Western psychology comes out of the Western medical model, as you were just saying, and from a medical model point of view, the focus is on what's wrong with the symptoms.
Oh, right.
What are the various syndromes? Even we have this term that's still around, mental illness,
mm-hmm.
which is really a metaphor that's borrowed from Western medicine. So the focus in Western psychotherapy has been and still is, at least in the mainstream, finding out what's wrong and applying various kinds of approaches, therapies to...
remedies to fix it.
Exactly.
Remedies. But fix it to what? You know, I think about the MMPI, or the Minnesota Multiphasic mm-hmm. Personality Inventory, and the so-called Minnesota Normals, who are the bachelor farmers that Garrison Keillor talks about. You know, what is normal in our culture? I mean, we don't even know that, really.
That's what it really comes down to. The best that's usually said is that normal is the absence of disease or illness.
Right.
So the perspective that my colleagues and I at Animus Valley Institute have been taking is rather, what does it mean to be fully human?
Yeah.
What does it mean to have cultivated the full spectrum of our magnificence, of our capacities? And a delineation of our human capacities and resources is not something we find in mainstream Western psychology. We do find it, interestingly enough, in mythologies all over the world, including Western mythologies. Carl Jung and his colleagues and students certainly began to approach that as well in many ways. But there has never been, to my knowledge, a systematic and comprehensive inventory of what are the various capacities and resources that we're born with, that we don't embody fully in our life unless we have had some support from ourselves and others to cultivate these capacities.
And most of the time we don't grow up in families that even know what that's about.
Exactly.
And are exposed to socialization in school systems, again, that are kind of in this stratified idea of what normal should be, but it's really not a, it's so interesting that it's not a conscious thing about what normal ought to be. I mean, I don't know, we could go into that further.
Yep.
But you talk about the totality of our capacity and that's larger than ourselves. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, it's certainly larger than our egos.
Mm-hmm.
I should say that for me, ego is not a negative term at all. In some spiritual circles, it is.
Right.
For most of us psychologists, the ego is simply a way to refer to the part of our psyches that is conscious of itself, which is one of the...
So our conscious attention.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Whatever we think about ourselves and whatever we're consciously aware of, that's the realm of our ego. And we can't be human without an ego. So from this perspective, the problem in human psychology or cultural life is not the existence of egos, but the existence of immature egos. And the goal of our work at Animus is to help egos mature and to deepen, in particular, into the roots in the soul.
Right. If you're just joining us, I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm sitting in for Elijah Howarth on Original Minds, and my guest today is psychologist Bill Plotkin. And Bill, you're going to be talking tonight at the Dance Palace at 7 p.m., and you're going to be giving a workshop in Bolinas from 10 to 4 tomorrow.
That's right.
And we're talking about Bill's book that has just come out called Wild Mind, A Field Guide to the Human Psyche. And you're talking about... my goodness, taking a fresh start with Western psychology in, and we were just talking about the ego, and I remember reading years ago, there's an article by George Miller called The Magic Number 7 Plus or Minus 2. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Vaguely familiar with that.
He was talking about that our conscious mind only has the capacity to handle 7 plus or minus 2 bits of information at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a rather narrow mode for us to be attending to this huge amount of sensory stimuli that's going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we select what we're going to attend to? And I think one of your points is that this small window, as Alan Watts talks about it, the spotlight consciousness versus the floodlight consciousness, that's what we think we are here in the West. That's all we think we are, right? Would you say that's true?
Yeah, it's culturally determined or limited in some ways.
Yeah.
Our culture suggests what's worth doing,
mm-hmm.
what's important to attend to, and it's actually a very limited piece of the pie of the possibilities. And that's one way in which our psyches are limited by our current cultural traditions. So
and by the concept of Western psychology, too, right?
Or, yes. Yeah.
All right.
For example, there's this is something Jung pretty much said, too. He did a different version of this, but there's four functions of consciousness, four ways to know the world.
Mm-hmm.
He referred to perception and thinking and feeling, and then his fourth one was intuition. I studied with a man in the 80s whose name is Stephen Gallegos, and who was also a Jungian.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that fourth function is better referred to as imagination, actually.
Ooh, I like that.
And interesting enough, let me back up just a second. By intuition, what most people mean is our capacity to know things without really being able to explain how we came to know it.
Mm-hmm.
Our psyches have that mysterious ability. And... for Jung, as it turned out, his intuition worked through imagination.
Oh, yeah.
The way he came to understand things is through images, and he many people know that he drew them, for example, in his book, The Red Book.
Oh, that's such a fantastic thing that has just come out onto the market several years ago.
Yeah. So Steve Gallegos pointed out that Jung's intuition worked through the window of imagination. And that's actually the term that Gallegos uses. He refers to the four windows of knowing. That as humans, we have been granted four ways to know anything, to know about life. And they're totally different windows, and one cannot be reduced to the other. And, and again, the way Gallegos referred to them are sensing or perception, mm-hmm. and second, feeling, third, thinking, and fourth, imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that these are these four windows of knowing, in some ways, it's a little bit simplistic to say this, but in some way they correspond to the four, what I call the four facets of the self.
I was going to ask you about that.
The self, that's with a capital S.
And what is the self, first of all?
The self is this, you could say, this tool bag in some ways, this set of resources that has all our fullness. So in that sense, the self is another way to refer to it, refer to our human wholeness. What is it to be wholly human, fully human in all our dimensions?
That's much, much more than ego.
It's much more the ego. The question is, how much does the ego have access to the fourfold self, the four facets of the self?
Yeah.
And what are part of our work at Animus, in addition to the encounter with soul, which is our primary work, we have a secondary focus of helping people consciously access all four of their facets of wholeness, together which, again, I refer to as the self, the fourfold self. And there's at least four kinds of reasons or purposes for cultivating our wholeness. I borrowed a term here from the psychologist Jean Houston, who refers to wholing. That's W-H-O-L-I-N-G.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the goals of becoming fully human. Is another way to say what that goal is. It's wholing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So cultivating our access and our ability to use the four facets of the self is what it means to become more whole. And the four, at least four kinds of purposes for doing that. One is our own emotional or psychological healing.
Healing from?
Emotional wounds.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, psychological trauma, difficulties from our childhood and so on. In contemporary Western psychotherapy, healing is usually thought of as something that's provided by the psychotherapist. And, of course, if a good psychotherapist does provide the setting,
mm-hmm.
and the psychological resources for the healing of the client, the therapy client. But I've come to understand that the deepest kind of psychological healing is something we provide for ourselves. But then, of course, there's the question, how do we do that? How do we provide for ourselves? And the shorthand answer is that we first actually cultivate our wholeness to some degree, and then we embrace our woundedness or our fragmentedness from our wholeness. And that way we're self-healing. Are the resources that we have been granted by nature, our indigenous nature, are now consciously present in our lives, and among other things, they enable us to embrace our woundedness, not get rid of any parts of ourselves that are fragmented or hurt, but to embrace them and help them heal and become integral parts of our everyday functioning.
But you have to start from wholeness to do that.
You have to start with at least some wholeness, and if you don't have your own, then you're going to hope to have a psychotherapist
who can hold that for you,
or a family member or an elder
who
can provide that space. But we're all capable of providing that space for ourselves. Those of us who are most wounded definitely need the help of someone else to get started.
Because I was going to say that, you know, sometimes people get so traumatized that they have no access to even understanding what wholeness might be, because they're they're so contracted, and rightly so, and constricted from the difficulty that they've had.
Yes, they don't understand wholeness because of that, but also because in contemporary Western societies, it's not even spoken about what our wholeness is, and that there's even a opportunity to access our fullness and grow more deeply into it.
And, you know, that's one of the things, because you've written two other books, Nature and the Human Soul and Soulcraft, mm-hmm. and now with Wild Mind. These are kind of guides and volumes to what our wholeness can be. Is that right?
Yes. Well, the new book, Wild Mind, is in particular, I call it what's introduced there, a nature-based map of the human psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
so if someone is wounded, they can say, oh, there's something more here.
Yes. And one sense in which the book is a field guide is it actually goes through all the different categories of ways in which we can be psychologically wounded. And in this particular model, there's four kinds of ways we can be wounded.
Right.
There's subcategories within each four. And then there's also these four facets of our wholeness.
Uh-huh. And if you're just joining us, I'm Anthony Wright, and I am a substitute host for Elia Howarth on Original Minds, and we're here with my guest, Bill Plotkin, who has written a book called Wild Mind, A Field Guide to the Human Psyche. And you're going to be talking at the Dance Palace tonight at 7 p.m., Bill, and also conducting a workshop at Commonweal tomorrow at in Bolinas from 10 to 4.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that you can call the Point Reyes Bookstore or go online at ptreyesbooks.com and get more information about these. And can you tell people about your organization and how to get in touch with you through your organization?
Yes, Southwest Colorado is where we are. It's Animas Valley Institute. And the website is www.animas, that's A-N-I-M-A-S, animas.org. And you also can find some information, especially about this new book, at a website, which is wildmindbook.com.
So with this map of the field guide to the human psyche, I'm looking at page 23 and 22. We've got two maps, the intrapersonal view of the self and subpersonalities, and interpersonal view. So what's the difference between inter and intra in terms of personality?
Yeah, the intrapersonal view is how we experience ourselves, our own psyches. Just directly.
Okay.
And interpersonal has to do with how other people are likely to see us when we're manifesting any or being in the mode of any particular of our elements or psychic parts.
And you recommend that people start with themselves first, is that right? And coming to some kind of understanding of their own topography before working on externals?
Yeah, you could actually do it either way or simultaneously. Mm. But the reason there's two maps is that the kind of terms or names or archetypal names that we use for the various parts of the self, of the psyche, vary depending on whether we're looking at someone else or someone's looking at us, rather, and whether we're looking at ourselves. So there's two ways to help us understand the
because they're kind of the same thing from the different side of it.
Just different perspectives.
Okay.
I'm remembering now what I was getting at earlier was that the new book, Wild Mind, is looking at all the different parts of the psyche. And a contrast that listeners might understand is the most common map of the psyche that's known in mainstream Western world is Freud's map of the psyche, and he had just three major components, which are the ego, the superego, and the id.
The id. Well, and that's the territory of the richness.
Yeah,
would you say?
As a matter of fact, and so as a psychologist, I found Freud's map to be very limited. It seems to leave out almost everything about our magnificence or about our wholeness. Almost everything about it, actually, and has a very limited view of the ego compared to what it can be. And there's all these other parts on the map, the nature-based map of the human psyche, which is what is in the new book, Wild Mind, actually has 11 categories of components, which might sound complex, but in some ways we might say, well, that's still kind of simplified because the human psyche is so varied and complex.
Right.
But 11 components gives us a lot more language to talk about the differences than just three components.
And I really do like the way that you link these with the ordinal directions, north, east, south, and west.
Well, that's a really important part of it, Anthony. The map is based on nature's map of wholeness.
Yeah, I was going to ask it. Did you get this from a study on indigenous practices also?
Maybe it began that way in some ways. I'm thinking one of my teachers in the early 80s was a woman, a ceremonialist named Elizabeth Cogburn from New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I did study the four directions, the significance of the four cardinal directions with her, and also right. with another teacher, Dolores La Chapelle from southwestern Colorado, where I moved at that time, still live. Mm-hmm. So, but it turns out that that the four cardinal directions have been used as a map of wholeness in by cultures all over the world, including our own Western cultures, including our Western religious traditions. We find the four cardinal directions, and often what we actually find in mythologies and traditions around the world are either four or seven. The seven directions, that includes, in addition to the four of east, west, south, north, it includes the direction of up and the direction of down and the center. So we actually have seven directions.
Yes.
And so what we find in traditions all over the world is that the seven directions are used as a template for what wholeness of anything is, including the wholeness of our own human psyches. Mm-hmm. The architect, what's his name? I'm blanking on his name right now, but refers to that we need a pattern language. Christopher Alexander is his name, and he has a book, in fact, called Pattern Language. And so when we're wanting to map anything, it helps to have a pattern that we're using. So the pattern I use, and again, this is we find in traditions all over the world, going way, way back, is the seven directions. Mm-hmm. So what I did, along with my colleagues at Animus, is mapped the human psyche onto the seven directions. And in the horizontal plane, we have the wholeness of the self. And there's a particular facet of the self that resonates with the qualities of north, and another facet that resonates with east, and then one with south, and one with west.
These are sort of they're sensory, are they? Because I'm just getting a flavor to it, or and I suppose it's a part of your teaching for people to have direct experience with themselves in the ordinal direction.
Yes,
because it's something that's beyond a thought process, even, isn't it?
Yeah, what would you call it? It's an experience. It's
right.
an experience of yourself. You could say it's four different frames. Ways of experiencing yourself, or these four facets of wholeness. At least I can name them for you here. And
sure.
Going into detail, of course, you'd want to get a hold of the book.
Yes, and they will be available for sale tonight at the Dance Palace.
Yes. So the north facet of ourself, I call the nurturing generative adult. This is the part of us capable of taking care of ourselves and others, and also of the environment that sustains us all and is that we all come from. And it's the part of us that can heal ourselves and others. And
you know what? I'm going to stop you right now because we have to take a short break, and
okay.
we'll go back into the cardinal or the ordinal directions after the break. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your substitute host today on Original Minds, and we're here with my guest Bill Plotkin, and Bill has written a book called Wild Mind, A Field Guide to the Human Psyche. And how can people contact you, Bill?
www.animus.org.
Great. Well, we're going to take a short break and be right back, so stay tuned. You're listening to KWMR, Community Radio for West Marin at 90.5 FM in Point Reyes Station, 89.9 in Bolinas, and on kwmr.org on the Internet, and broadcasting on Channel 47 on the cable company. Stay tuned now for more Original Minds on KWMR. Thank you. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Original Minds, substituting for Elijah Howarth. And today, my guest is Bill Plotkin, who has written a book called Wild Mind, A Field Guide to the Human Psyche. And Bill's going to be speaking tonight at the Dance Palace at 7 p.m. and doing a workshop at Commonweal tomorrow in Bolinas from 10 to 4 tomorrow. Welcome back, Bill.
Thanks, Anthony.
And before the break, you were beginning to talk about the ordinal directions of the map of the human psyche that you have outlined on page 23 and 22 in your book, Wild Mind. And you were, can you start again, please, about what north is?
Yeah, these, I was starting to talk about the four facets of our wholeness. Mm-hmm. Again, these are facets of our humanity that are pretty much ignored by mainstream education and religion and culture. And need to be consciously cultivated in order for us to fully live them and embody them. And the north facet, as I was mentioning, is I call the nurturing generative adult. Generative, of course, means capable of getting stuff done. What kind of things? And in particular, the kinds of things that enhance, that sustain life and enhance life. And in the east, on this map of the psyche, the east facet of the self, I call the innocent sage. That's innocent slash sage. Like you, it's like it has two. There's two views of this one facet: is innocence and wisdom, which sounds paradoxical to most people. It should. The east is very much the east facet of the self is very much all about paradox and how what looks like to be opposites for us at first in life, like, for example, light or dark or feminine and masculine, turn out to be two aspects of one thing. And mm-hmm. It stretches our minds. It you might say it enwilds our minds embrace paradox. So, and also it turns out that innocence and wisdom are not that different, really. Sometimes we confuse, in the Western world, we confuse, we confuse wisdom and knowledge. Those are two very different things. Knowledge is more resonant with the North. And wisdom with the East. For example, a person can know a lot of facts, have a lot of knowledge, and not be very wise. Or be very wise and not know a whole lot about the facts of what's going on.
Specifics, right?
The specifics, yeah. So in innocence and wisdom, what one thing they have in common is their incorruptibility or their purity or their capacity experience the world simply. And that's this is the gift of the East facet of the South, is to see the big picture of what's going on, to get our blinders off, to lighten up. Humor is an important part of the...
Coyote probably lives in the East.
Coyote, all the tricksters, Raven, and so on, they live in the East and they live in us. And we can access that. And people who tend to take themselves too seriously, and I have definitely been that kind of person... it really balances out our experience of life to cultivate our East facet of the self, which, as I say, can be thought of as the trickster as mm-hmm. well as the innocent and the sage. Mm-hmm. And a fourth archetype that resonates with the East is the fool, the sacred fool.
Oh, yeah.
The one who's beyond the rules, the norms of everyday societies, neither for or against cultural proprieties in order to open up to a wider view of life. Mm-hmm. So that's the East. This is a very quick tour through the four facets of the South. The South facet is one I call the wild indigenous one. There's a part of all of us, of course, that's indigenous. We're all part from Earth. Whether we're still culturally indigenous or indigenous to a particular place that our ancestors lived, we're still all terrestrially indigenous, we're from here, and this South aspect of ourselves knows that, knows it somatically, knows it viscerally.
You're talking about in the body.
Totally in the body. The South facet is very embodied. It's emotional. It loves all the emotions, experiences itself as kin, as a relative to everything that exists, all these species, not just other humans.
Right.
All the habitats. So the South, the wild indigenous one, just fully experiences its indigenosity, its wildness in that aspect, and is fully at home here in the human body and in the wild. The wilderness is our primary home, as far as the south facet of herself would say, no question, that's where I belong.
Because I took a trip to Europe. I have not been to Spain, but on my mom's side of the family, I'm Spanish, and my dad's side of the family, English and in Scotch. And it was really interesting to stand on the very dirt that my ancestors came from in England, you know. And I haven't been to Spain yet, but I look forward to going there.
Yeah.
Because there's a different sort of non-verbal, non-cognitive connection. But in a way, with all of these points, you're talking about getting involved with a non-cognitive understanding. Is that right?
Or beyond cognitive. Again, think of the four windows of knowing. It's not just cognition, which is associated with the north.
Right.
There's also the sensing, the five senses, which is more associated with the east, and the embodied emotions of the south, and the deep imagination of the west.
Yeah, talk to us about the west.
Yeah, the west I call the muse beloved. That's muse dash beloved. These are two aspects of the west. The muse, of course, is our deep imagination.
Mm.
Our capacity to access a kind of knowing that that is unbidden and arises by itself from our own depths. So our deep creativity is in the west facet of the self. And the other half of the name, the beloved, is referring to the inner beloved, that there's in popular culture, we often refer to the other half of ourselves. And in mainstream popular Western culture, the other half of ourself is often we're referring to our what we might call our soulmate, this other person that we hope to meet, or maybe we think we have met, that completes us. But from the perspective we take at Animus, this is the wrong view entirely, actually.
That's a projection onto another human being.
That's exactly what a psychologist call it, is a projection. We're projecting the other half of our own individual psyches onto someone else. And this makes romance more difficult than it is anyways, which is... And the West, by the way, the West facet of the self is our inner romantic. It's the part of us who has this deep allurement, not only to this other half of our own psyche, but, of course, to the world. And one thing that my partner, my guiding partner and romantic partner, Jeanine Marie Haugen, she and I have been designing and offering programs, especially at Esalen Institute in the winter, which we call Romancing the World, in which we spend 5 or 6 days in practices and ceremonies in which help us fall in love with the world that much more fully. So it's the West facet of the self that is most capable and longing to fall in love with this world. Like this sense that we were made for this world, the world was made for us, that we've landed in exactly the right place by being born as humans. And this is something that is not encouraged in contemporary Western society, this love affair with the world. Because if we did grow into our the West facet of our wholeness and allowed ourselves to fully fall in love with the world, we would treat the world way better than we do as a culture.
So there's a real disconnect there.
There's a real disconnect, and it's necessary for mainstream Western culture to exist. That there, and our cultural traditions tend to suppress, not just ignore, but suppress all four facets of our wholeness, but especially the West, the Muse Beloved, and the South, the wild indigenous one, are especially dangerous to Western culture.
I remember Alan Watts in one of his radio talks responding to criticism about Westerners were materialists, and he said, well, if we were really materialists, we would take much better care of the stuff that we live in.
That's a really good angle.
Yeah.
Nice twist on that one.
Yeah.
That's true.
So if you're just joining us, I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm substituting for Eli Howarth today on Original Minds, and I'm here with my guest, Bill Plotkin, who has written a book called Wild Mind, A Field Guide to the Human Psyche. And Bill is going to be making a presentation tonight at the Dance Palace at 7 p.m. and then giving a workshop at Commonweal tomorrow in Bolinas from 10 to 4. So could you talk a little bit more about, now we have a familiarity with the Western direction, with the four directions, in the human psyche. Talk to us a little bit about the suppression, how we get disconnected from this, and then I would also like to know a little bit more about, you have a term called subpersonalities.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we get disconnected from our own psychic topography?
Well, with the best of intentions, our families and our teachers mold our consciousness into a very limited realm that is most useful to mainstream Western culture, or as it's been called, industrial growth society, or our dominator society.
Okay. Yeah. So we can fit in.
So we can fit in, and we all want to fit in.
It's a survival thing, too, right?
It is, yeah. We all want to fit in with the people we're born to and our culture. We all are born with a deep longing to belong. And unfortunately, contemporary Western society has, over the last hundreds of years, actually thousands of years, has been somewhat distorted or twisted into a very limited version of our wholeness. But as children, we do our best to fit in. And so that's how we lose connect. We're actually born with a connection with our wholeness, our four-faceted self. But we tend to lose that through childhood and early adolescence.
It seems to me in my study also of indigenous cultures and listening to Clarissa Pinkola Estes that I broadcast every Sunday night, she's talking a lot about the real capacity of the elders to hold this this real dark terrain. And when we cut ourselves off, as we have in the West, from our elders, we lose that, because the elders are in a position to kind of hold this dark richness for us. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, it's kind of like the East facet of ourself is kind of like the inner elder in some ways.
Oh.
Capable of holding the bigger picture, including
right.
The darkness of our West facet, which is on the other side of the circle. The problem today, among other things, is that we don't have many true elders.
And being an elder is not valued in this culture so much.
We want to distinguish elders from senior citizens. They're not necessarily the same thing. Elders usually are older people. But older people are not necessarily elders.
Okay.
So really briefly, you could say an elder is someone who has at some point earlier in their life been initiated into their true adulthood, which is very rare, actually, in the contemporary Western world. My guess is maybe something like 10% of humans reach what we used to call true elderhood.
And really?
What I think of as true elderhood.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's because of the suppression of our wholeness and the difficulties we have completing the tasks of the developmental tasks of childhood and adolescence.
Yep.
So a true elder has become a relatively rare thing. And elders are the ones who hold the big picture of the world. They're the ones, the way in my second book, Nature and the Human Soul, I refer to the task of elderhood as caring for the soul of the more than human community. That doesn't mean other than human, not more than human.
Because you've got eight stages of human development here in Nature and the Human Soul. And
yes.
The elder stage is
the last two of eight
stages. Seven
and
eight.
Yeah. So Nature and the Human Soul is different from Wild Mind. Nature and the Human Soul is a developmental psychology. It's eight stages of ecocentric or soul-centric life that we are meant to go through as humans. That I believe it's a way of looking at the design pattern of psychological development for humans, these eight stages. There's two of childhood and two of adolescence, two of adulthood, two of elderhood.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it sounds kind of... It's sad to have to say this, but Western contemporary mainstream culture is designed in such a way that we do get through into the third of the eight stages, which is third stage being early adolescence, and most people
right.
tend to get stuck right there.
Oh.
And not make it to even late psychological adolescence or adulthood or elderhood. But the, as you were saying, Anthony, elderhood, the elders that who do exist are absolutely essential. They're a central part of all societies. In healthy societies, elderhood is the highest status.
Right.
In our society, senior citizens or older people are really in some ways the lowest status. This has turned everything upside down.
Yeah.
In order for a consumer society to exist, we have to have lost our consciousness of the deeper values that the true adults and elders hold.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk also about in your wild mind you have, because I remember you have sub-personalities,
yes.
And I remember particularly in the Red Book, but he speaks of it elsewhere too, Jung had an ongoing relationship with a kind of a guide into his unconscious called Philemon.
Mm-hmm.
Was Philemon one of Jung's sub-personalities?
I'm trying to think. Remind us a little bit about Philemon.
Well, Jung would have dreams and would want some guidance in these dreams, and Philemon would show up as a guide to not necessarily interpret. I'm trying to remember also about Philemon's exact function, but it seems like this is kind of not too dissimilar, because Jung developed a rapport with Philemon,
mm-hmm.
and would be offered some awareness about Jung's own wild mind, if you will, from Philemon that Jung didn't expect. And it would seem like the sub-personalities have an access to this deep material that our conscious mind doesn't have.
Yeah, that's resonant with my memory of Philemon. Jung's Philemon, but in that sense, I would say no, it's not a subpersonality at all.
Oh.
It might be his West facet of his self.
Oh, I see what you're talking about.
It might be his muse, or his another term for the muse, or the beloved, is the guide to soul. Philemon.
So there are these parts that show up that are main parts to us, that are that go along with these ordinal directions.
Yes, and I would say Philemon is probably one of the facets of Jung's wholeness, probably that
uh-huh.
West facet.
Right.
Where the sub-personalities, that's a term I borrowed from a school of psychotherapy called psychosynthesis.
Oh, okay.
Which was developed in the early 20th century by an Italian psychiatrist named Roberto Assaggioli.
Oh, yeah.
But there's all kinds of different terms that we find in psychology for what I call subpersonalities, and what I'm referring to here, what I mean by subpersonality, is the wounded or fragmented aspects of ourselves, which is what the place where most Western people actually live more often than not, in their own psyches.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other names for the subpersonalities are complexes, which is we find in Freudian
yeah.
psychology, or Gestalt psychologists would call them just parts, or others would call them voices, and wounded, in this case, wounded, fragmented voices. So, the new book also maps our four, our human woundedness, our fragmentedness, onto the four cardinal directions.
And there are methods you have that you suggest for being in contact with these parts?
To recognizing from our conscious self, our ego, that we're might be stuck in some wounded place.
Oh, by a reaction that we have no idea that we're going to have before we have it.
Yes, or influenced by contemporary advertising, which tries to keep us in a wounded place.
Oh, right. Yeah, buy XYZ and you'll feel better, and this will...
Exactly. So yeah. We feel inadequate, of course, and it's our a wounded part that feels inadequate in that way. So what I've done in this book, along with my help from my animist colleagues, is to map the four kinds or categories of woundedness that we can run into. Now, these four categories are much more familiar in Western psychotherapy than the four categories of wholeness. So we were talking about before.
Because they're pathology.
So even mm-hmm. the terms that I use will be familiar to most listeners. So, for example, in the North, we have the inner critic. And also... the inner flatterers, the ones who try to make us small by flattering us. For example, these are stereotypes for men and women. For the masculine inner flatterer in Western society might say things like, you're really a macho dude.
Oh.
When things get tough, you get going and you take care of business and you don't feel much because feeling is for wimps.
Right.
That's the kind of programming that a lot of us men have gotten in the Western world.
Yep.
So it sounds like flattery, but it actually makes us smaller.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm here with my guest. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm a substitute host today for Eli Howarth on Original Minds, and I'm here with my guest, Bill Plotkin, who has written a book called Wild Mind, A Field Guide to the Human Psyche, and you're going to be giving a talk at the Dance Palace tonight at 7 p.m., and a workshop tomorrow at Commonweal in Bolinas from 10 to 4, and if you... my listeners, give a call to the Point Reyes Bookstore or go online at ptreyesbooks.org or com, I think it is, ptreyesbooks.com. You can find more information about Bill's talk and his workshop tomorrow.
So, by the way,
yes.
What I'm going to be talking about tonight is somewhat different than what we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be primarily looking at the mysterious descent to soul, which is an initiatory process that we all humans very much long for, and we find almost no traditions or methods anymore in the contemporary Western world for the encounter with soul.
And you'll be talking about how to do that?
How to do it, what it means.
Oh, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, that's my favorite topic.
I'm really looking forward to this.
And, well, thank you, and we'll also relate it to the subject of Wild Mind.
But it also relates to your other two books, Nature and the Human Soul and Soulcraft, too, in terms of developmental stages.
Yes. Again, Nature and the Human Soul is this eight-stage model, ecocentric and soul-centric model of how I believe we humans were designed to grow, the stages we were designed to go through. And of those eight stages, it's in the fourth stage of life where we're actually psychologically and spiritually prepared for the first time to make the descent to soul.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. That fourth stage, which I call a cocoon, is actually the stage that our Western mainstream educational and religious systems make. There are actually obstacles to our ever reaching that fourth stage.
Oh.
And then my first book, Soulcraft, is the book that focuses on the descent to soul in particular. That tends to happen first and foremost in the fourth of those eight developmental stages.
So tonight you're going to talk about getting in touch with soul.
Yeah.
That sounds just fascinating. How did you come to this work? And I remember particularly a story, you know, I talked to you, I believe it was in 2008, mm-hmm. and you were talking about, you were sitting out in the wilderness and you saw a tree that looked like a monk. And the monk was pointing a direction. Can you tell us that story again?
Yeah, that's actually from a story from my first vision fast, maybe more commonly known as a vision quest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to say that a vision quest is, that term is taken from British anthropologists referring to Native American rites. But vision quest-like experiences are found in cultures all over the world, including our own Western mystery traditions. So back in the late 70s, I met two of my most important teachers in this lifetime. It's Stephen Foster and Meredith Little. These are two people here from California, from the Bay Area, who were bringing and did bring the Vision Fast tradition back to contemporary Western society. And actually, I didn't meet them till the early 80s, but I corresponded with them starting in the late 70s, and I learned from them the basic universal pattern of the vision fast. And I was out in Colorado, and so I just took myself out based on their written instructions or template. I took myself out for my own first vision fast, 5 days alone in the end of summer at tree line at about 11,000 feet in the northern Colorado Rockies, and fasted alone for those 4 days, four of those 5 days.
Just with water?
Or just no water.
Okay.
Just water, yep. And for those listeners who have done something like this, you'll understand, and others might find it a little bit hard to imagine, but our consciousness shifts in a very strong way through those 4 days of fasting alone in a wild place. And we're able to see things or experience things that we don't in our everyday, ordinary consciousness. And we, among other things, we're in full communion with an animate world. We no one has to convince us that everything is alive and everything breathes and everything speaks, because it's true. And
so that all the consciousness that we have in everyday life kind of drops away.
Exactly. Yes. And we move into a much more alive, vibrant, magical, wondrous world, which is in fact the world. And during that those 4 days, towards the end of those 4 days of fasting, I was in conversation with a few different beings and species. But among them was a spruce tree on the edge of this lake at Treeline, just below Treeline, obviously, because there was this spruce tree there. And we were in a conversation about all kinds of things. We're starting to run out of time. We don't have time to go into detail. But I was watching the spruce being in conversation with a beaver in the lake, for example. And at some point, the spruce tree, who became, in my consciousness, became a monk, a very simple monk, gazing upon the still surface of the lake. The monk, whose back was to me, made a gesture with his left arm, and I followed that gesture to the left and saw a large yellow butterfly flying towards me. And it did. Not only flew towards me, but it brushed my left cheek, and as it touched me, it said the words, "Cocoon Weaver," and which... it wasn't just an interesting term or image. It was this was an encounter with soul.
Yes.
And one thing that's true about the encounter with soul is that it's like thunder that strikes us at the very, very depths, and it changes us alchemically forever. And all I knew at that point was that my life would, going forward, that was at age 30, going forward would have something to do with learning how to weave cocoons, places of transformation, for myself and others, and that's really what I've been doing now since then.
Well, we are out of time, I'm sorry to say. I'm so thankful that you could come and talk with us this morning.
Thank you, Anthony. It's been my pleasure.
And I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your substitute host today on Original Minds, and we are here with my guest, Bill Plotkin, who's written a book called Wild Mind, A Field Guide to the Human Psyche. And first of all, you're going to be talking tonight at the Dance Palace at 7 p.m. and giving a workshop tomorrow in Bolinas from 10 to 4. And how can people contact you, Bill?
They can contact me and the Animus Valley Institute at www.animus.org. And animus is the Spanish word for souls. It's A-N-I-M-A-S.
Great. Well, thank you so much again for being with us, Bill. I'm Anthony Wright, and I've been your host today on Original Minds.